It's not your imagination. Kindness, compassion and empathy are on the decline. And tribalism, cruelty and isolation are on the rise. This is what the research shows, says Jamil Zaki. He's a professor of psychology and director of the Social Neuroscience Laboratory at Stanford University. But there is hope. Jamil uses the latest science to show how empathy is like a muscle which we can build or leave to atrophy. His new book is called The War for Kindness, Building Empathy in a Fractured World. And Jamil Zaki joins us now. Hi there.
Hi.
Disagreement seems to be the hallmark of public discourse at the moment, Jamil. Does that go for scientists too when it comes to defining empathy? Is there agreement on what that word actually means?
Thank you for starting here. I think it's really important that any conversation about empathy begin with a definition, because sometimes it can feel as though there are as many definitions as there are people talking about this subject. But there is, even though we disagree sometimes, some consensus among psychologists. The first is the idea that empathy is actually not really just one thing at all. Instead, it refers to multiple ways that we respond to each other's emotions. So, for example, let's say that you're having lunch with a friend and he gets a phone call and you don't know who's on the other line or what they're saying, but you can tell it's not good because your friend starts to cry. Mm. Well, while you watch your friend break down, a bunch of things might happen in you. You might become upset yourself, sort of vicariously catching his feelings. That's what we'd call emotional empathy. You might try to figure out what he's feeling and why. That's what we would call cognitive empathy. And at least if you're a decent friend, you probably care about him and wish for him to feel better, which we call empathic concern or compassion. And these pieces sometimes split apart, but together they constitute the kind of full sum of human empathy.
Do you need to have empathy in order to be kind?
No, I don't think so. You can be kind out of a sense of social obligation. You can be kind because you want to have a better reputation or because you want someone to reciprocate and be kind to you. Kindness is a behavior and empathy is an experience. They're not necessarily the same thing at all, but I will say that loads of data demonstrate that when people feel empathy, they are more likely to act kindly because they're sort of driven to, they're moved to emotionally.
President Obama referred to something called the empathy deficit. What evidence is there that empathy is on the decline?
Yeah, so the most common way that psychologists measure empathy is just a questionnaire. So people get a series of statements and they rate how well each one describes them on a scale of 1 to 5. So for instance, I might ask you how much you agree with the statement, I often have tender, concerned feelings for people less fortunate than me. Right. So that plus 27 other questions gives you an empathy score between 1 and 5. And hundreds of thousands of people have taken this test over the decades. And recently, psychologists sort of put all this data together. And what they found is that in 1979, the average American, at least, had a score of about 4 out of 5. So, you know, like a solid B on the empathy scale. Mm. And by 2009, that number had gone down to a 3 out of 5. So, in other words, the average American in 2009 reported being less empathic than 75% of Americans just 30 years before. So Obama was pretty right on when he said that there was an empathy deficit, at least in that regard.
A lot more people living in cities in 2009 than there were in 1979. Could that have something to do with it?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, so one thing to be really clear is we can when there's a change over time, it's really hard to say exactly what caused it because, of course, correlation is not causation, right? The fact that two things happen at once doesn't tell us that one thing made the other happen. But the decline in empathy has been occurring at the same time as we're more atomized than we have been in the past. We're more likely to live alone, less likely to interact with people frequently, and more likely to interact in ways that are anonymous and transactional. It's also empathy's also been on the decline at the same time as our politics have been driven further and further apart.
You write very beautifully. You say being a psychologist studying empathy today is like being a climatologist studying the polar ice. Each year we discover more about how valuable it is just as it recedes all around us. Where do you see that erosion of empathy happening?
Oh, my gosh. I mean, it seems as – so, you know, I interact with younger generations in two different ways, right? I'm a college professor, so I interact with sort of Gen Z. And I noticed that they are, you know, sort of, I do not ascribe to the stereotype that they are unkind or narcissistic as a generation, but I'll tell you what, they do seem to be experiencing a massive amount of stress. And there's this sense that stress draws us into ourselves and makes us feel like we have to focus on ourselves to the exclusion of other people. And I do feel this sort of sense among teenagers and young adults that they're sort of required, they're in this arms race where they really can't afford to connect in the way that they might want to. And then I also have two young children who are 4 and 2. And, you know, I think about them a lot and the sort of future that they'll grow up in. And, you know, I mean, to me, I feel like if you were to take a newspaper headline from today and send it back 5 years in time, I think that at least for me, my past self would be shocked at just how much mudslinging and cruelty there is in our public spaces. And I keep on thinking, gosh, if this keeps on escalating and moving in this direction, I fear for the world that my kids will grow up in, just the same way that I fear for the way that they'll, the sort of environmental impact that they'll be feeling as adults as well.
You said that that technology has moved us in the wrong direction, although it didn't have to be that way.
That's right. Yeah. I mean, I think of technology and social media in particular as a sort of our greatest empathic opportunity of all time, right? I mean, you can connect with anybody, anywhere, anytime on their own terms and respond with empathy. The issue is that that's not how the biggest social media platforms we have been constructed, right? They're not really built to connect us. They're built to keep us online so that we can click on ads. And that often means playing to our weaknesses instead of our strengths, right? So you end up with these social media platforms that favor vanity and outrage and division instead of careful listening or communication at a deep level. So I don't think of technology as inherently empathy negative. I just think that we should really take some control and put some intention into the way that we build and use these platforms.
I'd love for you to tell us about the Roddenberry hypothesis, named after the creator of Star Trek.
I'm always happy to talk about Star Trek. It just so happens that Star Trek The Next Generation is my favorite TV show of all time.
Right.
This is outing me as quite the dork here, but that's okay. So on that show, there are these two characters. I'll never forget them, right? One of them, the ship's counselor, Deanna Troi, is sort of known throughout the galaxy for her high levels of empathy. She sort of can immediately feel what other people feel and as a result knows what they feel. And on the other side, you've got the ship's lieutenant commander, Data, who's an android. He can't feel emotions and as a result is colorblind to the emotions of other people. And neither of these characters has any say in the matter, right? Deanna Troi is a betazoid, so it's genetically determined that she will be empathic. And Data is literally hardwired to be unempathic. And as I sort of entered the psychology of this field of empathy, I noticed that people were talking about empathy the same way that Gene Roddenberry was, that each person is endowed with some level of empathy by their genes that's hard-coded into their brain, and they're going to stay there for life. So some people are empathic, some people are not, and that's just who we are. It's not something that we can alter.
Yeah, I did an interview maybe a year ago which had a big impact on me, and the theme of the interview was that the opposite of empathy was psychopathy. Is that how you feel about it?
It's interesting. I mean, people with psychopathy certainly have lower levels of some types of empathy. Interestingly, you know, we talked about one part of empathy is understanding what other people feel. It turns out that people with psychopathy are perfectly able to understand what people feel. They just don't share their feelings or feel much concern for other people's well-being. So which, as you can imagine, is a poisonous combination, right? So here you have people who are often quite savvy about others' experiences, but can use their insights to manipulate or even harm others. I mean, think about it. Propagandists, even torturers, need for their work to understand other people's emotions, not because they care about them, because they need to use them to accomplish their goals.
I'm speaking with Dr. Jamil Zaki, who's professor of psychology and director of the Social Neuroscience Laboratory at Stanford University. And his new book is called The War for Kindness, Building Empathy in a Fractured World. So that's a little bit about the brains of people who have a lot of empathy versus those who don't. But then experience matters too, right? The upbringing you have will impact how much empathy you have for others.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, we talked about the Roddenberry hypothesis, this idea that empathy is a trait that's just built into us and we can never change. It turns out that that's not true. Now, there is a genetic component to empathy. Let's be clear about that. And there's all sorts of evidence for that. But our genes might determine where we start out, but they don't have to determine where we end up. And there's just as much evidence demonstrating that everything from the household in which we're raised to the experiences that we have as adults to the friendships we form and the habits we choose all can affect how we empathize. And importantly, that means that we can make choices that help us empathize more productively, more effectively, and more broadly.
You write in the book about some examples of people who had to work to develop a greater sense of empathy. Tell us about the former white supremacist who sort of turned his hate into something else.
Yeah, so this is Tony McAleer, a really interesting guy who, you know, unfortunately as a child was really isolated, angry, and alienated. And, you know, he takes full response. I'm not trying to chalk up his behavior just to that, but, you know, it turns out that he found solace and community amidst the fans of these white supremacist bands, these like punk bands that sort of were explicitly sort of had these neo-Nazi leanings. And he ended up becoming a real sort of leader in the Canadian neo-Nazi and white supremacist movement and was totally lost to the world for a period of time, just like made of hatred. But he actually found his way back. And part of it was by making a connection with someone who he was supposed to hate. So he befriended somebody who he didn't realize at the time was Jewish, and they became really fast friends. And then eventually this guy sort of told him, oh, you know, that I'm Jewish just in passing conversation. And Tony decided to open up and say, well, you know, I've actually done a lot of these anti-Semitic behaviors and have these anti-Semitic attitudes. And he expected fully this guy to either, you know, punch him in the face or walk away or curse him out or whatever. And instead, this man showed him compassion. He said, that's what you did, but it's not who you are. You're better than that. I see you. And that simple act of compassion really cracked Tony open, right? I mean, it made him realize that he had self-worth that went beyond just hating people who were different from him. And it set him on a path to reform. And now he actually, with some colleagues, founded a group called Life After Hate, meant to extract other people from hate groups. And they've sort of helped thousands of people. And I think Tony's case is really a great example of how we can lose our empathy when we're isolated and alone and angry, and also how we can get it back by broadening the people we connect with and really understanding that people who are different from us are people. They're not just representatives of a group, and those close social connections across group boundaries are really vital in that way.
Yeah, and his story is anecdotal, but science tells us something too, doesn't it, about the benefit of spending time with people who are different to us.
Absolutely. Yeah, there's a long-standing, quite, you know, really robust tradition in psychology based on what's known as contact theory. So the idea is that basically tribalism and division, one of the weird things about it is that it makes us very incurious about people who are different from us. It makes you reduce somebody who is in another group to just being, oh, they're just a Republican or a Democrat, or they're a member of a certain race or age or whatever. But, you know, people just are way too complicated to be explained in that way, right? I mean, we have all sorts of idiosyncrasies, and it turns out that when you meet someone, when you befriend someone, even, for instance, when college freshmen have roommates of different races than themselves, that decreases our prejudice. It decreases our animus towards outsiders because we realize that outsiders are people and that they are, you know, that they might have one part of their identity that's different from ours, but so many things that we actually share.
We mentioned the empathy deficits earlier. Is there a connection between that deficit and the debate on climate change?
You know, I think that there might be. There's not a ton of work on this, but one of the interesting things, you know, in my book, I talk about the way that, you know, we have evolved to empathize, but we've evolved to empathize when it's sort of when it comes naturally. So for people who are right in front of us, for people who look and think like us, and for people who we can see. Right. And it's a heavier lift to empathize with people who are thousands of miles away or people who are different from us. That doesn't mean it's impossible, That actually means that it's more important for us to work at it because we can build our empathy through practice. But I think that this also pertains to future generations, right? Maybe one of the hardest tests of human empathy is whether we can care about people who will never, who we will never meet, who have not been born yet, and who will never know that we existed, right? Future generations. And yet our ability to empathize with them might be a huge part of our willingness to sacrifice some of our comforts to ensure that they have a livable future.
Are there selfish reasons to empathize? Is it, are there benefits to developing empathy?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I always feel like in some contexts, like, you know, in business contexts, I'm often asked to provide the bottom line case for empathy. And I'll tell you what, it's actually quite easy to do. You know, I mean, it turns out that empathy, we often think of as a transfer of well-being from ourselves to another person. But empathizers, the people who experience it, benefit in all sorts of ways themselves. Right? They tend to be happier, experience decreased stress and depression. They have an easier time forming close relationships in new parts of their life, like new college students who are empathic make closer friendships more quickly. They have an easier time maintaining important relationships. They're happier in their marriages. Right? They're more effective at work and are naturally seen as leaders. And when they come to leadership positions in organizations, end up managing other people more effectively. So I think you can easily make the cynical bottom line case for empathy, but I always return to also the idea that we shouldn't necessarily need that case, that yes, empathy helps you, but it also is, I don't know, part of being something that's bigger than yourself.
So for whatever reason you want to become more empathic or empathetic, for our listeners, can you give them some tips? How do you exercise that muscle?
Oh, absolutely. Yes. I mean, there's sort of ancient traditions that help us here. So certain types of meditation practice have been demonstrated quite rigorously to increase people's empathic abilities and actually change their brains in the process, which is pretty amazing. Immersion in fiction, in stories, can be a powerful way to build empathy, whether it's novels or attending plays. There's now evidence that everything from acting to reading short stories increases our empathy, including for people.
That's incredible, eh? And we have a very we have an audience of readers, and you know, there is a benefit to reading novels. There's a real life benefit to it, huh?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. In expanding, you know, if you think of empathy as the combination of our emotional instincts with our imaginative capacity, right? I mean, basically, fiction is you're going to the gym for your imagination, right? So you're expanding the scope of who you can connect with. You can empathize with people who have never even existed. It's really a uniquely human feat. And, you know, I'll say that the bad news is for people like me who love to read nonfiction articles about psychology. That turns out to not really help us very much.
Friendship is helpful.
Yes, especially diverse friendship, right? I mean, getting back to Tony McAleer's story and contact theory, one of the best things that we can do is to become really curious about people who are different from ourselves, right? And I mean, we can do that through novels. We can do that through imaginative exercises where we like write what it might be like to be a member of a different group, but there are also people who are different from us all around us, and getting to know those people is one powerful way to expand our empathic palette.
Do you practice this, Jamil? I see you're on Twitter. Do you follow people who you don't agree with, and do you get anything out of that?
Well, let's draw a line between really interacting with somebody and following them on Twitter, right? I mean, I think that when I talk about interactions across groups, there are some types of interactions across groups that are harmful to empathy, not helpful, right? And those are ones that are reduced to you're just seeing the most inflammatory content about another group. You're just seeing them, you know, express an opinion that you hate, you know? So, I mean, I'll answer your question, which is that I do follow people I disagree with, and I often don't feel like I'm empathizing with them more as a result. I think that's part of the issue with the way that we communicate, is that if we substitute that level of social media participation with communication, we'll not just be losing what we could have gained, which is real understanding across groups. We're gaining a sense of threat, of the other side being more threatening even than perhaps they really are.
Okay, so it's not enough. It's not enough. You've got to do it in real life, and not just people who, in fact, probably politically not so much people who disagree with you, but just people from other walks of life and who have experienced different things to you.
Yeah, I think that's right.
Meditation too pops up.
That's right. Yeah, there's a type of meditation called loving kindness meditation. This is a practice that, to some Westerners sounds a little bit, new age, but it's not. It's actually quite old. But it's a practice of basically extending compassion and goodwill, first to ourselves, then to people who we care about, then to strangers, and then to all living beings. And there's a couple of things in it that I love. I mean, first is the idea that we really need to empathize with ourselves. It's crucial. And sometimes we lose that in the whole process. We think that to be a good person is to care for others, and it's somehow selfish to care for ourselves. But in fact, lots of evidence suggests that when we care about ourselves, we get more effective at opening up to others. And I mean, if you're addled and damaged, you're so stressed all the time and you are full of self-hatred, it's really difficult to extend past yourself and reach out, right? So I like that about loving kindness meditation. And also, again, there's lots of evidence that when people practice it regularly, they really do get better at understanding other people, they become more generous towards other people, and they tend to share other people's emotions more as well.
The title of your book refers to a war to make people more kind and compassionate towards each other. Does that give us a clue as to how hard you think it's going to be to change behaviors?
I get a lot of questions about that type. How can you wage a war for kindness? Isn't war fundamentally unkind? And I think that it depends on how you view it. I mean, war, as I see it, is a conflict between different goals and a conflict between different outcomes. And right now, I see that I used to have a more anodyne title for the book when I started writing it in 2015. But as I was writing it, I felt like, gosh, there are these really powerful cultural trends that are moving in the opposite direction. And I think that if we don't do something, if we don't fight for empathy, if we don't fight for kindness, then I do think that they're endangered. I do think that sometimes stopping to listen to somebody who's different from us feels like a radical act these days. It feels like counterculture in this odd way, which is especially odd because doing that, connecting with each other, is what made humanity what it was in the first place, right? So I do think that it requires concerted effort and even concerted struggle against other trends to reclaim that common humanity. But I think it's a critical and vital thing that we must work at. I don't know whether we'll win or not, but I just know that we need to fight.
And when you look around your classroom at Stanford, does it give you cause for optimism?
Yes. In fact, it's not just here at Stanford, right? So since the book came out, I've received hundreds of messages from people who say, thank you. This is exactly how I want to live. I want a more empathic culture, but I'm the only one. And I'm always like, can I just put all of you on a group chat or something? There's so many of you. I feel like sometimes the loudest voices in our culture are not the kindest. And it's easy to feel as though those of us who want empathy and kindness are alone. But we're not. There are many, many of us. And sometimes I think the first thing in creating a movement, a cultural movement, is recognizing how many people there are just in the woodwork who might not be saying so, but really feel the same way that we do. So one thing that I always tell people is, notice the empathy around you. And when you empathize, when you act kindly, don't be afraid to make that empathy loud. Because, I think that once we see how many of us want this, we can start to push harder for it.
Dr. Jamil Zaki, Professor of Psychology and Director of the Social Neuroscience Lab at Stanford University. The book is called The War for Kindness: Building Empathy in a Fractured World, and I've loved talking to you. Thanks for your time.
Oh, thank you so much. That was fun.